We will move now to item 16, which I would like you to introduce.
Well, right before that, I'm going to introduce somebody to my right here. This is Marnie Aiello. She is from Region 2. She is an attorney with the Office of Chief Counsel, and she's joining us today. It takes two people to cover Jessica's work. Three people, sorry. And that's because they already have full-time jobs.
But we will be on our best behavior, so.
And you know, we'll one other thing I want to acknowledge. I mentioned this to Ms. Cervantes earlier in yesterday's meeting, and I also wanted to publicly acknowledge the staff of the city of Watsonville. We've been coming here for years, and they are fantastic to deal with. They really show well for the city. So thank you to the staff. Okay, let's move on to item 16. This agenda item is a hearing to, let me back up and say, item 16 is a 2014 integrated report assessing waters of the Central Coast region, including Clean Water Act 303D list of water segments not meeting water quality standards, and Clean Water Act Section 305B water quality condition report. This agenda item is a hearing to adopt a resolution approving changes to the 303D list of impaired water segments. Additionally, this is an informational item on the Central Coast Region Integrated Report that will include both the 303D list of impaired water segments and the 305B water quality condition report. These documents serve to inform the board and the public as to the health of our water bodies by identifying which water bodies and pollutants do and do not meet protective water quality standards. This guides the Central Coast Water Board in priorities and timing for our surface water programs. Mary Hamilton of our staff will provide a presentation on this. I'll hand it over to you.
And before we start, since now we have formally started this agenda 16, and I'm closing speaker cards on this particular item. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Little mic check. I'm not used to speaking into a microphone. Chairman Wolf, members of the board, good morning. I'm here to talk to you about the integrated report and the proposed updates to the 303D list of polluted waters and the water quality condition report. Essentially, it's a comprehensive water quality data assessment informing us on the status of our creeks, beaches, lakes, rivers in the Central Coast region. By way of overview, what I'm going to talk about today is the requirements to update the 303D list of polluted waters and the water quality condition report, the timeline under which we did this, present you some results, talk about the public comments we received on this item, and then provide this board with our conclusion and recommendations. I'm giving you a little sneak peek here of some of the results I'm going to talk about. This is a map of our region showing water bodies that were categorized into either polluted condition or into either good or unknown conditions shown in blue. So first, we'll start with some requirements. Clean Water Act requires in Section 303D that the states develop and periodically update a list of water bodies that are polluted. The EPA is required to approve changes to this list, and for every water body and pollutant combination that's placed on the 303D list, states are required to develop a total maximum daily load or an alternative to a TMDL that accomplishes the same goals. Clean Water Act Section 305B requires that states report to the EPA on the conditions of its waters. And although the water quality condition report does not require approval by EPA or the states, we provide it here for your information and consideration as well. Now, when combined, the requirements of the 303D list updates and the 305B water quality condition report packaged together called the integrated report, and we submit this to the State Board and to EPA as a package. Other requirements are laid out in California's listing policy. The State Board adopted a listing policy in 2004 that guides our process for developing updates to the 303D list. The policy requires that we gather data and solicit for data from the public to inform these updates, that it has rules about the quality of the data that can be used to make these updates. The policy guides us on how we can identify relevant criteria or evaluation guidelines to interpret our narrative water quality objectives when we don't have a numeric water quality objective. The policy talks about what's required in a line of evidence and how you summarize what data was collected by whom and where and which criteria we're using to evaluate that data, how many samples are present and are evaluated, and how many are exceeding that criteria. And then the policy further tells us how to combine those lines of evidence into a single fact sheet for a water body and pollutant combination. And then it has rules about how to make decisions for those fact sheets as to whether or not that water body and pollutant should be placed on the 303D list. The policy goes on to require that we develop a schedule for developing TMDLs for every water body and pollutant combination that's on the list. And the policy has requirements for public review and comment, as well as approval by both the state and regional water boards. I want to point out that this update builds on the previously approved 2008-2010 integrator report. And that integrator report was informed by data that was gathered in a public data solicitation back in 2007. The timeline for developing this current update started immediately following the approval of that 2008-10 list. And so State Board released a notice requesting data be submitted from the public in January of 2010, and there was an 8-month public data solicitation at that time. As soon as that public data solicitation period ended in August of 2010, State Board and Regional Board staff started developing the assessments, creating those lines of evidence, summarizing the data, putting them together. By about mid-2013, it became obvious that there was no way that we were going to be able to, that State Board staff were going to be able to complete the assessments statewide for all the data that was submitted in 2010. So at that time, they told the Central Coast Water Board we were going to take a pause, and they defined a new timeline and approach to finish assessing all that data collected in 2010. This is just showing you that approach, which is they essentially divided the 9 regions into 3 groups. Group 1, which did not include the Central Coast, they continued working on their assessments, and they completed the 2012 integrator report. As soon as that was approved, Central Coast staff, who were placed in Group 2, we got back to work on our assessments, and we are completing the 2014 integrated report. Group 3 will complete the 2016 report. So in March 2015, the 2012 report and Group 1 had finished their work, and we got back to work on our assessments. In August of this year, we completed those assessments and released them for public review and comment. During the public comment period, we also held a public workshop September 14th of 2016 at the Central Coast office. And our public comment period ended in September 23rd of this year. We're here today at this meeting to present our recommended changes to the list and the water quality condition report to this board. And the next steps are to submit the integrated report to State Board. Their target board hearing date is the July meeting at State Board. And State Board will compile the 3 regions integrated reports here in Group 2 into a single 2014 integrated report. So the 2014 report only will contain changes for those 3 regions that are in Group 2. And then ultimately, the integrated report is submitted to EPA for their consideration and approval. One of the primary reasons this takes so long is that the amount of information we're evaluating is ever-growing. The workload is ever-growing in this region. As you know, we're very fortunate. We have several large, high-quality monitoring programs. So when you collect a lot of data, there's a lot of work to do to evaluate it. I'm showing you here the progression of kind of the general amount of information we're evaluating, comparing the 2014 report, which is what we're talking about today, to the 2008-10 report, which was approved in 2009, and the 2006 report, which seems like a really long time ago now. This table shows the number of lines of evidence. So again, those are the individual summaries of each data set, the what, the when, the how, which criteria we're using, all of that. then those lines of evidence are combined into fact sheets, and a decision is made for every single fact sheet as to whether or not to put the water body and pollutant combination on the list. And in 922 cases, we decided that the water body and pollutant combination should be placed on the list. So again, this assessment cycle, we developed 23,055 lines of evidence, combined those into 5,431 fact sheets, made 5,431 decisions about whether a water body should go on the list or not, and in 22 cases, water body pollutant combinations are recommended for the 2014 list. So I do want to point out that even though we have 210 more water body pollutant combinations for the 2014 list, that doesn't necessarily mean we have 210 brand new problems or that this is a trend and things are getting worse than they were in 2008. What it does mean is we have a whole lot more data to assess this time to inform these decisions. And I really want to point out that, keep reminding you that this assessment for 2014 is based on that data we gathered up in the 2010 solicitation, and that the solicitation process is required in the policy. So every time we update this, there's going to be a cutoff date. Data was collected here. We started assessing it. That takes a little bit of time. We acknowledge there's a lot more data available since that time, and it wasn't included here. But I want to assure you that that data is being used when this board makes decisions. It's used by our TMDL programs and permit programs. Yesterday you heard about updates to the monitoring and reporting program for the irrigated lands program. Those changes were all based on the most recent, most current data. When we develop TMDLs, we gather up every piece of information we can and evaluate what we can use for the next assessment. The key thing here is that all data that was collected since the solicitation and is in the state surface water database, the CDIN database, it's not only used by our programs, but also it's gathered up by the CCAMP group. Every month we download data from CDIN. We reevaluate that data compared to criteria for aquatic life protection and human health. We score those monitoring sites report card style on our website. We also do some trend analysis with that data. So we do summarize new data information, make it available in easily visualized formats for the public. But this assessment is based on the cutoff date from the data solicited in 2010. And most importantly for this item, all data that's in CDIN, when we get around to the next solicitation, which is currently scheduled for 2020, all that data that's in CDIN will be gathered up and assessed in our next update to this integrated report. There is an exception to that rule, and that's when there's data types that don't fit into the CDIN formats. Those data can be submitted separately. So that's stuff like continuous monitoring data, temperature data that's collected every 10 minutes. We don't have a format in CDIN for that type of data. So that the policy does allow for that data to be submitted separately. But in general, the listing policy now defines data to be used for 303D updates is the data that's in CDIN. And with all that in mind, I'm going to walk you through some of the results of this assessment. This table shows the number and each type of decision we made for this update. The listing policy directs us in how to decide whether water body and pollutant combination should be placed on the list or removed from the list. And based on the decision-making roles in that listing policy, we recommend removing 83 water body and pollutant combinations from the list. The good news there is about a third of those are due to water quality standards attainment. They are now meeting the criteria of the policy to remove something from the list. The other two-thirds are due to administrative procedural things. In a lot of instances, we had, like Monterey Harbor, for example, was on the 303D list for metals, just a generic metals listing. We recommend removing it for metals because now we're assessing the harbor for each individual metal. So we have 10 new decisions there that replace that one. So things like that are some of the administrative reasons some of the D-list decisions came out. The evaluations using the rules and listing policy, we recommend 922, which I already mentioned, added to or remain on the list. And the majority of our decisions were do not list, don't add something to the list at all. And in some cases, that's because there is a large body of data and they are not exceeding criteria and we know the water body is in good condition. And in other cases, there's not enough information to make a decision based on the rules and the listing policy. There's one sample or two samples, and so that's not enough information to inform a decision. So taking you back to the 922, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the pollutants that we're recommending to be on the list and show you the proportion of each pollutant type that we placed on this list. So of the 922 water body pollutant combinations, 252, or over a quarter, are indicator bacteria. That's slightly deceiving. It's not that we have 250 water bodies with a bacteria problem. In most cases, a water body is evaluated for multiple indicator bacteria. So using Pajaro River as an example, because we're in that watershed today, Pajaro River is on the 303D list for both E. coli and fecal coliform. Similar for pesticides, we have a lot of pesticides identified for this 303D list, and in many cases, water bodies are evaluated for multiple pesticides. Pajaro River, again, is on the 303D list for 7 different pesticides. We have several 96 recommendations for nutrients to be placed on the list. The majority of those are nitrate, some are ammonia. The toxicity number 59 for this list is interesting and telling of the amount of data we've collected since the last update to the 303D list. For toxicity, we did something different. Instead of splitting it into individual pesticides, we actually lumped the toxicity assessments this time. Previous assessment, we had different fact sheets for sediment toxicity and water toxicity. This time, we combined those into a single assessment for toxicity. But since the previous update in 2006, which, if you recall, is 1 year after we adopted the Ag Order and the monitoring and reporting program for that order, and early in the CCAMP history, we had limited toxicity data to inform the previous list. We have a ton of toxicity data now. Two other things I wanted to point out that may not be obvious what these are is biostimulatory responses. Those are things like low dissolved oxygen, chlorophyll A, algae problems. And then something new for the Central Coast this cycle is evaluation of benthic community effects. That's looking at the aquatic bugs and the community health of those aquatic invertebrates. We recommend adding 5 water bodies to the list because they are in poor condition for the biology, the benthic biology. I'm sure you're wondering how this compares to the previous list. And again, I want to reiterate that this is not a trend analysis. You bet.
Other.
Other is a category called priority organics, and PCBs fall in that category. So priority organics, every one of those, I believe there's 5, were on the list long in advance of the documentation we now have for the list. We believe they were based on tissue data from the Toxic Substances Monitoring Program and the State Muscle Watch Program, but they were placed on the list long before we had this robust documentation. And then I believe there's 2 PCBs in that category as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sure.
Just wanted to ask a question before you move off this pie chart. So you touched on this, but I just wanted to get a little clarification with pesticides and toxicity. So is it correct to say that we could have pesticides occurring at a level which violate a standard but are not creating a toxic effect?
That is true. In some cases, we will see concentrations that are higher than the LC50 or the concentration at which we think it should kill half of the test organisms. And the corresponding sample does not have a toxic effect. That does happen. I wouldn't say that's the common outcome, but it does happen.
When a sample is pulled for testing for pesticides, is that sample always also tested for toxicity?
Typically, yes.
Okay.
Not always. I can't with any certainty say always.
Right. But then again, and this data does not just come from CCAMP, right? It comes from many other sources.
Absolutely. And the majority of the pesticide and toxicity data evaluated here are CCAMP or the Cooperative Monitoring Program for Agriculture. But there are other sources of information included here too.
Thank you.
Welcome. So the next slide is showing you a comparison of those same pollutant groups with the previous 2008-10 list. And I want to reiterate, not a trend. The fact that there's more this time is more reflective of the fact that we have more data and information. I'm sure you're looking at the large changes here, which are in the indicator bacteria. Oh, I should begin by saying the green bar is the 2008-10 list and the orange bar is the 2014 list. We have 50 more indicator bacteria. A lot of that is due to the splitting and looking at individual indicator bacteria this cycle as opposed to just categorically indicator bacteria. The pesticide numbers have more than doubled, the number of listings have more than doubled, and that's largely in part to the amount of data we looked at for this cycle is much greater than in previous cycles. But I do want to point out that with the 2010 data solicitation cutoff and the data used here, there are very few pyrethroid pesticides included in this assessment and absolutely no neonicotinoids. So those data are not reflected here, and we know we have those additional problems. I also want to remind you, though, that when we develop Team DLs, think about updates to the monitoring and reporting program for the irrigated lands program, all of the available data, all of the recent data are included in informing those decisions. And then also wanted to point out here that toxicity numbers have increased even though we lumped those together this time. So that is also because we have several more years of CCAMP and cooperative monitoring program data that inform this decision. So what this is telling us is we have a lot more data and we're identifying more problems because we're sampling in more places.
Just one more time. Biostimulatory responses includes which?
It's dissolved oxygen, low dissolved oxygen, chlorophyll A, algae bloom, so microcystin problems like Pinto Lake, things of that nature. And then one last thing is the benthic community effects. We did not evaluate those data in the Central Coast last cycle. It was done in other regions, but not in ours. And we have 5 new recommendations for listing there.
And certainly, if you have questions, I think, these are good times to ask them because there's quite a bit of presentation. And then if we wait to the end, it kind of dilutes, so to speak, your ability to ask specific questions. So one that I have is on the pH. That pH is based on which criteria, because depending on the, often you have ambient pH conditions due to the geology of the creek bed and leaching out of certain minerals, which can impact the pH. So this is based on what?
So we have several pH water quality objectives. We have objectives for aquatic life, for recreation, and for drinking water. And in all cases, the combination of designated uses, we evaluate the data compared to each of those. So there may be 5 lines of evidence for pH because we're looking at all 5 objectives. Of course, the one that's most stringent is the one that will result in triggering the listing. And you're right, we do have several areas that are new to this list this cycle because of pH, and we are fairly confident that the geology alone explains the pH condition. But EPA has informed us that we can't just make a judgment call there. We need to put them on the list and fix that by either creating site-specific objectives or addressing the criteria if they're not appropriate for the specific areas.
So that's work in progress?
In progress, definitely.
And
the same is true for the number of salts in TDS.
Exactly. Yeah, because you take some streams where, say, you have geothermal activity. That's a natural
Correct.
Occurrence, and pretty hard to be improved to what nature has provided us.
Agreed. And there are many avenues we can take to figure out the best way to address those listings, but creating site-specific objectives is one of the options that we'll evaluate when we get there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary, for all your work on this. On this slide that we have, there are a few categories like sediment, almost metals, and other organics where there's same or just a bit fewer listings. Why is that?
Great question. So the ones for metals and other organics in particular, I'm glad you mentioned those two at the same time. There were some places where we didn't have the individual pollutants to replace that categorical decision. So in some cases, we left the generic metals as the pollutant on the 303D list because we don't have a large body of data to replace that with. So that's why the metals numbers haven't changed that much. We did remove a few, we did add a few, but in general, it balanced out. The other organics, the only change there was in one location, Moss Landing Harbor, previously listed for the organics category. we now have more information from Moss Landing Harbor, so we evaluated it specifically for all the pesticides, PCBs, PAHs. And so that one did come off for a few but was added on for others. So it was a balancing act for both of those because in both cases it was a categorical thing that we were trying to replace with specific pollutants. Sometimes that happened, sometimes that didn't.
Well, of course, I'm a board member here because I want to see improvements like everybody, so I was hoping that the metals might be an indicator of improvement, because when you mentioned Monterey Harbor used to have one listing parameter, now there's seven, I would have expected the metals to have gone up because you've started to specify or itemize them. Mm-hmm. So now that I see that they're sort of equal, I thought maybe that's good news. Maybe some water bodies have come off of the metals threshold or exceedance area, but that's not true. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, that is true in some cases. So Monterey, if memory serves, and I should look exactly at it, but I believe we took it off for metals categorically, and it went back on for two metals.
Right. So overall, I would have expected metals in 2014
right.
to have
so go up.
A taller bar.
Yeah.
But since it's equal, I thought maybe that's a chance for improvement and having the result of being removed, having some water bodies removed from metals. But all right. Thank you very much.
Okay, and then with this slide, I want to remind you again about the 922 total water body pollutants that we're adding to the or keeping on the 303D list, and talk about the sources of those pollutants. This is a breakdown of the most common sources that we identified for pollutants on the 303D list. Newly implemented this year is the procedure to only identify sources when we've done something, a source analysis like a TMDL or another source analysis. So in most cases, you'll notice two-thirds of the sources are identified as source unknown. But for those water bodies and pollutant combinations where a TMDL has been developed or we have some other source identification information, these are the most common sources identified on the list. And keep in mind that any given pollutant can have multiple sources. Nitrate, for example, each one of these things on the list could be one of the sources.
I'd like to ask a question here.
Absolutely.
I attended as a representative of this board, I attended a grazing riparian workshop, and a member of the public kind of skewered our board for paying so much attention to impairments due to livestock. When this person said there were so many source unknowns, why wouldn't we go after 604? If he was here today, he'd probably say, why wouldn't we go after 604 problems instead of focusing on the 126 for livestock? Can you address that?
So, again, these are I wouldn't say we're going after sources when we decide what we're going to develop our TMDLs for. We are picking our highest priority pollutants based on the priorities of this board. So those are things that affect aquatic life and human health. And in general, those tend to be toxicity, pesticides, nutrients, and in some cases other things like coliform indicators. And so I wouldn't say our TMDLs prioritization has to do with the sources as much as it does with addressing the biggest problems, the ones that are of most concern to this board. So I don't think the logic is parallel there.
So if I can add to that, Mr. Delgado, so this doesn't reflect the severity of a listing, for example, and that would factor into the prioritization that Mary's referencing. We look at the severity of the impairment. Does it violate a drinking water standard, for example?
And does the prioritization of TMDLs relate any way to sources unknown versus sources known? Are we more likely to develop a TMDL for a water body where the sources are known as compared to a given water body where the sources are unknown?
I'll let Jennifer speak to that since she's our TMDL senior.
Yes, Jennifer. So the answer is no. As Mary and John have alluded to, we look at it from a different angle. We start with what is the biggest problems and how to address it. We don't look at what are the sources and then do prioritization from there. So our TMDL development priority list is not based on source analysis.
So if you were to find a water body that we thought was high priority but source unknown, how do we establish the TMBL loading?
Well, so, and maybe that's what is a little confusing about this graph. So the 66% that are shown as source unknown, those are just everything that a TMDL has not been developed for has to get put in source unknown. We know what a lot of the sources are for things that are on the list. So if you take the 922 new listings, about a third of those we have TMDLs developed for. So everything you see on the top is for those third of the items. Everything else is that 66%. That just means a TMDL hasn't been developed.
I see.
Does that help?
Yeah, that helps okay. a lot. And that could have been an answer to the person who was concerned, because it was thought in the room that if the sources were unknown, they were unknown. But actually, it was just that they hadn't yet had TMDLs, and many of those could have had sources known.
Yeah, and that's one of the caveats here in the bottom is that on the previous listing, staff used judgment and did identify what we thought potential sources were for some of the pollutants when we had a pretty good idea. You know, we know a lot about our watersheds, and we, for some of them, have a good idea of what's likely causing the problem. We, in previous lists, did identify that, but what we're currently doing based on current direction is we're only identifying sources where we're positive, and that positive comes from the fact that we've developed a TMDL, we've gone through the lengthy analysis, the lengthy study, and we know what the sources are, and therefore it's put on this list.
So then, from what you just told me, is the tabulation here derived from a different method than the prior listing processes?
Yeah, so if you looked at the same graphic for the 2008-10 list, it would look very different because it did include things where we hadn't had a TMDL developed yet.
Thank you.
And I have a question on this table also, specifically on grazing and livestock. And I keep domestic animals separate. Sometimes they're considered to be family members. But putting that aside, on coliform, for example, you know, there's been often arguments made by farmers that the source of pollution is not necessarily the livestock or grazing, but wildlife, you know, such as wild pigs. And, of course, one of the technology available today, which is very cost-effective, is using DNA. So have we been using DNA on, you know, making these identifications?
Not in most cases. I believe DNA analysis is only used in one or two of our TMDLs, if I'm not mistaken. Unfortunately, until recently, it wasn't very cost-effective. It's become more so. And we haven't developed any TMDLs for indicator bacteria in the last 3 or 4 years. So,
because I remember this is maybe 2 years, 3 years ago. I believe this was in the Santa Maria area, and there were discussions about what the source was from.
Absolutely.
And so it had been agreed to use the DNA technology as a way of, you know, identifying clearly what the source is. And there's been cases with ocean water toward shoreline pollution alerts, and also DNA was used very successfully to identify what the source was. So I was asking that because, you know, again, as we learn more, since this is, you know, work in progress, I think leveraging newer technologies helps zero in a little more effectively on what the sources are.
I think it's important to note that for this 303D list, really what the sources are is not part of the assessment. I mean, we are looking at comparing the water quality data with the standards, whether or not it's a natural source, whether or not it's, you know, due to the natural geology, due to wild animals versus human. We're not looking at that at this level. We're simply putting something on the list because of comparing the data with standards. Then when we take the next step and actually develop a TMDL or do something else, that's when that additional analysis would be looked at. What is the real problem? What's going on? What are the sources? But that's a next step after this process.
Thank you.
I just had a quick question, if you could be brief on the prioritization process, the criterion that go into that, and then in terms of the time specified for attainment of those objectives.
So glad you asked
that.
We
have a slide coming up.
That's the next slide. And the good news is that of those 922 that are on the list, we've already completed TMDLs that address 298 of them, so about almost a third. And then we set three priority levels for all of the other water body and pollutant combinations on the list. The high and medium priority, the ones that are identified here as high and medium priority, those are pollutants that affect our aquatic life and human health benefits uses, so pesticides, toxicity, nutrients, turbidity, temperature. And so the high priority, the water body pollutant combinations that are placed in the high priority category, we expect TMDLs to be completed by 2018, and that's because those are ones that are already in our work plan. We're already working on them, so we're fairly confident we will complete those TMDLs in the next couple years. The medium priority were all the other pesticide, turbidity, toxicity, nutrient, pollutants that are not in the current work plan, but we want to get to those in the next 5 years. And then we placed everything else as a low priority, knowing full well that in 2020 we're going to do this again and probably reevaluate our priorities at that time. So that's kind of how we laid those out. Does that get
you? Well, yeah. I mean, you're addressing them within the 2018-2023 timeframe, but in terms of the attainment of the water quality standard to get it off the list, I'm saying what's defining that timeline? How do you make the decision to set the standard to have a TMDL eradicated within a certain time frame? Is there criteria for that? Are you clear on the question?
Yeah.
For example, you know, it's specified in the staff report that there's a specified time frame expected for the attainment of the water quality standard. So how are you setting that standard? How are you setting that time frame?
Part of the TMDL that's set in the TMDL, so step two after the list, and I'll let Jennifer speak to that a little more.
I'm not sure I quite understand the question. So specifying when
so you're developing
a problem is going to be resolved in that
correct
time
frame. So you're developing a TMDL, and you're saying that the problem should be resolved in what time frame? What drives the time frame?
Gotcha. And I think there's maybe you'll probably get a different answer than what is in the 303D list. So the 303D list comes up with their approximation of what might happen when putting in these criteria and even putting TMDL completion dates. This doesn't necessarily, and actually there's no way that this will represent reality. By 2027, we will not have addressed these 449 TMDLs. Complementary, I think, to your question is when a specific TMDL, so if you take the 59 that we're currently working on, at what point will the water quality standards be achieved? When we actually do the TMDL, we do that analysis, and we'll probably come up with a different answer than what was given here. We look at, you know, basically when we do the source analysis and what the implementation is, then we come up with an estimate. And a lot of times, as you know, with our TMDLs, those estimates are fairly long. We know it's going to take 20 or more years for attainment. So that more specific answer is done when we do the TMDL itself. This list takes a very cursory look and makes some guesses and puts things in appropriate buckets based on high, medium, and low priority, but it's not accurate, and you shouldn't look at this as what the future will look like specifically.
These are not attainment dates. These dates are the when we think the TMDL will be approved.
Yeah, I'm clear on what those dates are.
Okay.
Yeah, I was a deeper question as to how you're making the determinations on the TMDL timeframes. Obviously, this is highly aggregated, and you're going to disaggregate it and go through individual analyses. I guess I was just jumping to that conclusion. So I'm satisfied. Thank you.
Fair enough.
But
and each one's different.
I think also supplementing this, you know, there are some TMDLs which may not be achievable. That gets back to my two points I made earlier. The first one, for example, achieving pH in certain water body is not going to be possible. Number two, although right now we're aggregating livestock and grazing without knowing for sure if these are the actual source of coliform, as you discussed a little bit earlier, later on further analysis may determine that's not the case, that it is from wildlife. And where we do have wildlife corridors within our Central Coast region, it may not be possible to post signs saying, you know, wild pigs prohibited, you know. So I know I'm making kind of funny out of it, but I mean, it's the reality is that we can't look at this and look at it as achieving perfection. And what I'm saying, I don't think that's possible, right?
Yeah, and
deals are about. Go ahead.
As I say, and I also think it's important to note with your example for, you were talking about pH and salts coming from natural sources. So when we have a good idea that that is the case, those are going to be in those low priority categorizations. So it's not like we're running out and we're gonna start doing TMDLs on these listings that we know are likely from a natural source. They're going to put on the low priority list, and that'll mean that when we redo this list again, there's going to be other things that are higher priority lists. So those are never going to be a high priority for us to develop TMDLs for. And I know that putting it on the list gives people concern of, oh, you know, we might decide to do a TMDL for pH in the Upper Big Sur watershed when we know that that might be from natural sources. I think that's a concern that if you look at this, hopefully that helps alleviate that concern.
Yeah, and I, you know, appreciate you clarify that, because I think, you know, for the members of the public, that's important to hear that, because when people look at this at first glance, they may think, okay, this is a trigger for further actions without necessarily looking at these priorities that you have just identified, where the focus will be.
And you know how often we're able to bring TMDLs to you. It's not like we're able to produce 15 20 a year. I mean, they're a long process. They're very careful analysis. So we're chipping away at this very, you know, as fast as we can. But it's not like in a couple of years we're all of a sudden going to have, you know, gone through these 200 TMDLs and ready to tackle the low priority ones. I mean, that's just not the reality of the workload and the resources that we have.
I have a brief comment, if I could. This is kind of beating this horse here to death, but I wanted to be clear that those property owners or dischargers who are understandably concerned if a water body adjacent or on their property is on the list, that if it's in the low category, that they really should have no concern about a big hammer or regulation, a new regulation coming into their world because of that. Is that correct?
Well, so I think the answer is it depends. There are some existing permits that we have that if something is put on the list, trigger something. You know, so example, our irrigated lands order has some provisions that if you farm adjacent to a water body that is, I think, listed for sediment and has, then there potentially is some ramifications for us adding to that listing. So even if that was, for example, something that we put in the low priority category, us putting it on the list would have an impact. But there, for a lot of the low priority things, there isn't a mechanism that would trigger a specific action already in place, because just putting it on the list doesn't trigger any specific actions unless that action is already specified in a permit.
There you go. Can you hear me? Just to pipe in really quickly, I want to make sure we kind of, you raised a little bit of a legal issue for me, so I'm going to pipe in really quick, Mayor Dale Goddard.
And if you can introduce yourself.
Yes, Tamarin Austin, counsel for the board. And so the point I wanted to make is that you may be next to a low priority watershed, but you may be taking actions on your property that are causing a discharge or threatening to cause a discharge, and those types of activities would still be regulated regardless of whether or not a TMDL is under development. So I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you. Thank you.
Question I have that's a little different goes to the number of deletions that we have. And you mentioned that those were due to attainment of water quality standards. How did that happen? Was it because of our permitting process, or was it because of natural occurrences?
Well, I'll start by saying a few of them were simply more data added to the picture, changed the decision. where a water body was put on the list because it had just one or two, it had 20 samples and the cutoff was 19, and so it had just enough exceeding the criteria to put it on, and now that we have 70 samples, the decision-making rules fall the other way. So it was close when it got put on, and then it just got taken off. There are a few of those, but my favorite story is Clear Creek in the San Benito watershed, so east of here, but also this Pajaro watershed. And more than a decade ago, we identified a mercury problem there from some mining activities. We had some cleanup work done there. The CCAMP program, well, the sorry, I should start by the BLM did some monitoring showing us that there was evidence that it was cleaned up. And so the CCAMP program went out and collected enough data to justify, to show that, yes, it was cleaned up and to justify under the listing policy rules with enough samples that it was, in fact, clean. So we removed it. So my favorite story of this list is that one, because the cleanup action resulted in complete cleanup. We had non-detects for mercury in the creek in all 26 samples that we collected. So that was that's a great story.
What about the others? I don't want to hear just the good news. I want to hear the real news.
The real news.
Yeah.
So a lot of them were more information informed and made a different decision. So in some cases, the decision-making rules are if you have X number of samples, you need X number of exceedances to put it on the list or take it off the list. So in the previous assessment cycle, we had this much data to inform that. And in a lot of cases, five samples were exceeding a criteria, and that was enough to put it on the list. Now we have this much data, and so we have maybe 10 samples exceeding, but we have 90 samples total, which was plenty to say that the water body is attaining the standards. So I think that in the beginning of this process, when we first started following the listing policy with the limited data, we had several decisions that put it on the list because we had just enough exceedances to meet the criteria to put it on the list. And now that we have a huge body of data, some of those.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that we just have one example of where a cleanup effort or a permitting requirement has actually been the cause for attainment. And the rest is simply having better information, a better database in which to assess.
Well, and I'm not sure we actually went through that analysis. I guess I would hope and I would suspect that it's a combination, that there's some more success stories besides that specific example. But the analysis that she went through wasn't looking at the why. I mean, we could potentially go back and look at that to try to figure out where there are some other success stories. But I would hope that of those delistings that there are many or several examples where actions, because there are a lot of good things that people are doing in our watersheds, and that those actions, it's hard to imagine they're not resulting in some of these delistings.
Well, I'm hesitating because being a scientist, it's impossible for me to say A plus B equals C unless that's true. And so in many cases, we do have a TMDL in place, and the decision to delist, also, we have the TMDL in place, and the TMDL was likely part of that solution, but I wouldn't say it was because of the TMDL 100%. So I think my hesitation is just I'm afraid to.
Okay, I can appreciate
absolute.
That, and
I
can appreciate
what I mean?
With what you're doing, you're not looking at the cause and effect. But stepping back a little bit, as the Water Board is a holistic agency here,
absolutely.
Is somebody flagging that and saying, hey, our other, you know, cohorts down the hallway are looking at cause and effect for us?
So a few more examples I can give you are, for example, in the Santa Maria watershed, there's two. There's the Main Street Canal, and we were having some ammonia issues. We were seeing extremely high ammonia concentrations, and it was pulsing. It would be normal a few months, and then we'd see this massive spike. So the Water Board went looking for a source for that. We worked with the city, we did some inspections, we found a source, we eliminated that source, and since then we have seen that there's not that spiking condition, and so the ammonia condition has improved there. And another example is the Santa Maria River, also ammonia. We have delisted that, and there has been a lot of work done there for various implementation, management practices in place. All those things add up, and I'm sure contribute to that, but I can't point and say this whatever is the reason this
okay.
has improved.
But now my question is, what process does staff use, if any, to at least red flag something and say we need to, you know, take a look at what has caused this improvement?
A lot of it is the data. The data informs a lot of the follow-up work, like the Main Street Canal example. We were seeing these problems and brought it to staff's attention, and they worked with the city and went looking for a source. And that's also happened in Salinas many moons ago. We had the same problem, the Trail of Broccoli, if any of you remember those
Okay,
slides.
But Mary, my question is, what process does staff use to go through this? I mean, I know you're telling us from memory, which is fine because, you know, you're very familiar with the data. But does staff follow some process whereby it's following up with all these improvements and saying, we know why, here's why? Even if it's not you, is there someone else doing it?
So is the question, are we following up with the improvements or are we following when we see a problem? Because we certainly...
Well, I'm just talking about the attainments.
I guess I don't think we have an internal process where we're looking specifically for those success stories.
Except for with the TMDL report card process.
That's true. Yeah, we are doing some TMDL
report. I was also going to say the non-point source program tries to build success stories, you know, or there's a requirement historically to provide success stories similar, I think, to the report card.
Well, I could add a specific success story example, which within our Central Coast, Mr. Young, the Natural Resource Conservation District has installed many, many miles of fencing to prevent cattle from entering water bodies. And these projects were grant-funded, and they were specifically awarded through the Water Board, you know, reviewing grants to improve water quality. So I cannot give you exactly the number of miles, but... there's probably within the combination of all the RCDs in the Central Coast on an annual base, there's probably 25 miles.
And has that effort resulted in the delisting of any 303D bodies or improvement in water quality? That's kind of what I'm after here, is what is our process for red flagging this kind of information?
Yeah, I mean, we can certainly take a look through this cycle's delistings and look to see where we could look at it more closely for those success stories.
I should have documented that more carefully, too, well, for your information.
So, John, if I could just ask you, would it be useful for us to know what works and what doesn't? You know, and I'm being simplistic in throwing that out, but I mean, we're seeing attainment, improvement.
I think the answer is we don't know, but we won't know unless we look at that and test. Well, so is the information that we gained from that individual process useful in other aspects of that program or other watersheds that have similar listings?
Right.
You know, I can't say yes, that will be an effective strategy, that concept of capturing success and then trying to reapply it elsewhere. But we won't know until we deconstruct and then try it someplace else.
But I think it's a little more involved than that because, you know, as I'm thinking, you know, other examples in riparian corridor, I mean, there are miles and miles of creek where erosion control programs have been done by the California Conservation Corps, the NRCS, the RCDs. Again, I use that as a kind of a narrow example, but it's probably not easy to get your hands around that. And Lisa, do you have any input on that?
Lisa McCann, section manager. Here's what I'm thinking. Yes, we have that kind of information, and but we have not assigned the resources, nor am I convinced that we have them, to spend the time on an annual basis looking at an entire watershed to pull that various information together to link it to the water quality conditions. We could, and we have. So, for example, grants, all of our grant-funded pollution control activities, of which there are many, as you're just speaking about, do have their own documentation and load reductions or other indicators of success. We could connect that information as well as our own permit programs and implementation in progress and the various sources in these watersheds for the approved TMDLs.
I'm addressing something that complicated. How many deletions do we have? How many?
Sorry, 83 total.
83 deletions. Okay. Is it possible to go through that list and just red flag which are just based on better data?
Yeah, absolutely.
Primarily. Mm-hmm. There may be some improvement based on, you know, BMPs, but there must be an easy way to earmark or identify which ones are mainly based on better data collection versus those where we think there, you know, has been a cause and effect because of on-the-ground changes with something.
Yep.
And that.
And many of the 83, like I mentioned, are taking one pollutant name off the list but replacing that with additional assessments of a different type. But, yes, we can absolutely annotate that.
Yeah, because of the 83, about a third are from attainment of water quality standards. So we'd focus on just the third of the 83.
See, I just want to know, isn't that something that would make sense that they staff should be interested in themselves to know what works and what doesn't work? I mean, here we have some success stories because of doing X, Y, and Z. We need to look at that a little more. Maybe that is something that can be replicated in other watersheds. Go ahead.
I just would add to that, that kind of helps connect the dots. I mean, often we hear from folks, how do we know from the regulated community, how do we know if what we're doing is really helping to move the needle? We have different ways that we reflect that specific to those programs, but I think in this larger context, if in the 83 you look at actions that are in place that develop from our work specifically, I think acknowledging RCD and other resources to eliminate sediment and erosion and so forth, acknowledging that there's a suite of things going on, but being part of that suite of things, I think that does help to inform the public that in the big picture, these things are moving in the right direction. And hopefully 83 is not a burdensome review, but I agree with Mr. Young. I think it's a really good point. And from my perspective, it's something stakeholders would, I think, also appreciate seeing in the big picture.
I'm just going to echo that because, and I appreciate my colleagues being way more patient with the process than my questions. But I guess, you know, my point originally, nascently, was we're going through this tremendous process that is a lamentable time frame, frankly, not from your, you know, not because of any sort of lack of your ability to do so, but it's a very long time frame that we have gone through to get to this point. And you have a lot of aggregated data, which is wonderful, but in terms of connecting the dots to ensure that we're looking on a watershed basis, what programs do we have in place and what TMDLs are we putting in place to achieve those standards, I think is really informational for internal staff and our stakeholders. I think that's highly important because we're asking people to do some onerous things, and so we should demonstrate that we're going through a very deliberative process and on the outcome we're getting the water quality benefits that we want because we have put the right process in place. So I appreciate my colleagues for continuing to drill down, and I, you know, I applaud all of your work. It's tremendous.
May I add one more thing?
Yes.
The TMDL report cards are a vehicle for that. We have been doing them routinely. We would like to do more every year, but again, that's about resources. I think they do respond to and answer the questions that you're asking, and maybe what we could do differently that we haven't done the last couple of years is emphasize the ones that we know we've made progress on rather than maybe higher priority ones that we're still waiting to see the progress.
So. Right, and this is a long time frame, obviously. This doesn't happen in a year. You know, all these are going to be unlisted. But I think it's great to maybe have some benchmarking along the way and just communicate that. And I appreciate the report cards, but maybe making them, I don't know, something that we hear on a more regular basis, just sort of an update so that we hear it and the public hears it as well.
Right.
Thank you.
Maybe we can do a better job of communicating those outward to the board so they understand what progress and what successes are happening.
And I can do a better job of doing my homework as well.
Okay.
job. We won't grade you.
Not yet.
Right now, you're still in the A-plus category. So.
You're still on probation.
I'm still on probation.
Mayor Delgado, you had a question?
Yeah. The staff, I understand, from what I can tell, goes through a lot of workload due to the scientific rigor that's required for this listing and the regulatory process you must follow. And we're discussing something additional that could be done. And I don't want to underestimate the work that's already – I am very impressed by the amount of workload that goes into this. There's a 73-page attachment 2 to this issue that has several columns. One of them is the name of the water body. And the other one is whether it's removed, being removed from the 303D list. There's no comment column, and we talked about this in the briefing phone call we had. And if there was a comment column for that subset that have an X in the remove list, there could be a comment that summarizes the knowledge we have about why it's being removed. And if it was a lot of information attached to why it's being removed, let's say it was due to a lot of BMPs, you don't want to put all that in the comment, but maybe there could be a one-page write-up that the comment could refer to, and that one-page write-up would be the biggest burden on staff, is to professionally document why the knowledge we have about the source of removing, why it was removed. But I think a comment column would help the process.
And I'd like, though, at this stage, Mr. Robertson, to, after the summary of these comments, you know, let's very specifically frame what direction of a board will be, because we have had at times individual comments which were taken as actions and not necessarily reflective of the entire board direction. And also, I would like to give the opportunity and suggest the opportunity for staff to take the input and staff come up with what would be the best approach, rather than here on the fly, you know, make specific suggestions, add this column, and let's do X, Y, Z. So I just want to caution not, you know, to walk away with, okay, we're going to do a specific item. I think there is a general consensus which was driven by Mr. Young's observation to look at the why behind, you know, some of these delisting. So I think that's a good point. And then I think the general idea here is for staff to come up with what would be your most efficient and least labor-intense approach of encapsulating this information. And so that would be, you know, the takeaway. The other thing that we have to remember is all this information is looking at the rear-view mirror. And, you know, there's been quite a bit of time from when these data were gathered and analyzed. And we are now in our fifth consecutive year of drought, and we do know that in-stream flow has a significant impact on the behavior of various TMDLs. So I'm not trying to muddy the water and add turbidity where it's not necessary, but it's a fact. So sorry, it's Friday. So, Mr. Young?
Thank you, because Dr. Wolf summarized my thoughts pretty well. And it's the cause and effect relationship between the deletions on the 303D listing. And then, however staff wants to get back to us on that. In other words, it sounds like from what Lisa said, that information may be kind of in the TMDL reporting that you do. Maybe that's how you get back to us with it. When's the next TMDL reporting? Does anyone have an idea?
I mean, when is the next time we'll bring a TMDL
yes.
to you?
Well, I thought there was something.
The report cards?
Yeah.
We just put out Well, actually, I don't think State Board has posted them yet, but we do them each fall.
Okay, so perhaps, Dr. Wolf, that makes it easy for staff if they're kind of reporting at that time. We get that information kind of included as an addendum to that reporting. Or any other way that you want to do it that kind of makes efficient sense. So, great.
Thank you. I appreciate the notion that we sit down and talk and then come back to you with something that seems to make sense and the cost isn't too high with it. So I appreciate not trying to build the solution right now in this moment, and let's collectively talk
and
about that.
Doing it this way, I mean, while you're preparing the TMDL report card,
right.
You'll probably be thinking, okay, we also need to put information into this column to include with our report back to the board. May not be that problematic.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I thank you for those comments, Mayor Delgado. When you asked us for more information on those, I began down the path of adding a row of information for everything on this 73-page table and realized there were so many nuances, and to provide you with something that was accurate was not as simple as using what I have in my head to inform additional information. And I didn't want to just give you a partial picture. So, but for the future, we can consider if that's something that we can produce and make a table like this much more informative for your purposes. And spoiler alert, when you do get to see the report cards that are coming out from this fall, there is some good news in there.
Well, Mary, I want to thank you because today you presented something I hadn't seen before. It was a 2006 versus 2014 comparison. And we were talking just now about the big picture of success stories and why they happen, so that looking ahead, we might be able to implement those successful past techniques. But the other part of the big picture is being able to digest a lot of data. And that comparative chart that you showed, 2006 to 2014, you know, helped me know where we should be concerned or helped me understand. You said it wasn't for trend, but still, from the bigger picture, it helped to see that comparison. So, thank you. I'm sure that took some work.
And so that's an outgrowth of comments that Mary's hearing from the board. And you went back and cranked that table out after some discussion, you know, with the board.
Now we go on to the to next slides.
Well, and I did want to bring it back. I made a note while we were talking about what works in terms of TMDLs and when the condition is natural and stuff like that. And I did want to circle back to tools that work. And TMDLs are not always the appropriate tool. When we dive into the problem and we realize, oh, this pH or this salt problem is natural, we may choose to use a different tool than the TMDL process to get at that, like creating a site-specific objective or something else. And then also just wanted to reiterate that TMDL development is about identifying controllable sources and implementing practices that will control those. And so natural causes, obviously that's not controllable. So I just wanted to circle back to that really quick before we move on, because I know that you guys had mentioned that when we started this discussion. And now I'm going to transition to the water quality condition report results and back to that map that I showed you in the very beginning. And the water quality condition report is about combining all the various information we have about a water body, so all the fact sheets, all the lines of evidence, and then making a determination about how to categorize that water body. And the condition report has five categories that range from good condition, known good condition based on a large amount of data, an unknown condition based on insufficient amount of data to inform a decision, and then two categories for polluted conditions. So all water bodies that are on the 303D list for one or more pollutants, they would fall in this polluted category. So Pajaro River, for example, we evaluated 86 fact sheets and made 86 decisions about pollutants for the Pajaro River. Zero of those were to remove something from the list. 20 of those were to add or keep something on the list. And 66 were do not add something to the list. And then those all add up to a single decision to categorize it into the polluted category because something's on the 303D list. So what I'm showing you here is the 388 water body segments we assessed as part of this effort. And what you can't see is all the little beach segments because they're only 150 meters long and it wouldn't show up on this this level of a map, this zoomed out version. But you can see the surface, the inland surface waters in our lakes and rivers, and 71 of the water bodies, the 388 water bodies, were actually categorized as good condition, and that has to be based on a large body of data, based on the rules of the decision-making rules and listing policy. You need a lot of information to be able to say it's in good condition. There were 92 water bodies where we didn't have enough data to make a decision, and then two water bodies which we identified as potentially threatened. And this potentially threatened is important because it's a new category to this 2014 report. We didn't have this category before. And the two water bodies that we placed, can you hear me? Sorry, I'm leaning away. The two water bodies that we placed in the potentially threatened category are Carmel River and Big Sur. And I point those out because those water bodies both have a large body of data and information. And for all the pollutants we assessed, there was no exceedances of criteria. None of the pollutants indicate that there's a problem, no pesticides, no nutrient problems, no oxygen problems. But when we looked at the benthic community data, the biology, those communities are in poor condition in both of those rivers. And so although we don't know exactly which pollutant is causing that, and therefore can't put it on the 303D list because you need a pollutant to put something on the list, we wanted to separate them out and identify them as something's going on here. We need to go figure out what it is. We don't know what it is yet. So those are our two potentially threatened category water bodies, and then 223 water bodies, which remember include some beach segments that you can't see here, are in the polluted categories and colored red on this map.
I'm sorry, I just have one question. So what's the difference between the potentially threatened and the unknown sourced?
So potentially threatened means that there's some indication that there's a problem, and the benthic invertebrate data is a little different. The policy actually has rules that are specific for that type of data. The policy says unless you can, you also have a pollutant problem that you can blame the benthic condition on, then you can't put it on the list. So when we had, if we had a pollution problem, it would have gone on the 303D list altogether. But we do have a lot of data there, no pollution problems, the benthic community is in trouble. So that's why they were put in the threatened category. Whereas the other ones that are in insufficient or unknown, one sample for one parameter or very limited data sets. So we just didn't have enough data to inform a decision to say good or bad.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Arms are too short to move fast. I'm guessing we'll hear more about the Carmel River and Big Sur in particular because of the way you found, because of the discussion and comments that you received regarding flow. So I want to have that conversation at the right time in your presentation, but I'm very anxious to get to that because I think it's a really important new development.
We agree. Flow condition is extremely important.
Yeah. So
I do have a slide about the flow condition comments, so we can circle back.
Mary, I had a couple of tiny questions. Numerically, about 388 water body segments, and in your narrative that you've been talking, you've kind of crossed, you've moved back and forth between water bodies and water body segments. So do we know how many water bodies that are inland, not counting the beaches, do we know how many water bodies we have?
We do, and I don't have that number off the top of my head, but there are, I would say, a dozen or so water bodies that are segmented into more than one segment. Salinas River is a great example. We segmented it into three segments. So the upper segment is above where Nacimiento and San Antonio come in and the dam releases. The middle segment is from Nacimiento River north to about Gonzales, and the lower segment is Gonzales to the ocean.
So is it true then we only have 12 water bodies that have multiple segments?
I wouldn't say just 12. It's approximately that. I would have to go look. But, yes, we have several where we've created San Luis Obispo Creek has two segments, for example, and I would have to put about minutes of thought into it. But there's about a dozen-ish.
Okay, so we have about 370 water bodies and about 388 water body segments. Mm-hmm. In the future, it would be nice for me, in particular, to know how many water bodies are in the good quality that don't have any segment that is basically polluted. And especially if that's an easy number to get to arrive at, that would be
And you
be
mean
nice.
Inland surface waters, not counting the beaches?
Right.
Yeah, the term segments, I think, aside from the fact that some water bodies are segmented, those beaches are not really a water body, right? It's a stretch of beach adjacent to the ocean. So the segment term is a little bit awkward.
But
inland surface waters, certainly we can.
But the use of a term segment and the methodology of segmentation of water body, isn't that also driven by what you are required to provide to the State Water Board?
It is, and in some cases our basin plan actually delineates different segments. The Salinas River is another good example of that, where in the basin plan there are three segments and each segment has different beneficial uses designated to it. So in some cases the basin plan drives that. In other cases we identified a logical hydrologic break where, for example, a lagoon, Scott Creek, 11 miles of creek, and then there's a lagoon, and we have monitoring going on in the lagoon as well, and we expect that condition to be different. It's completely different hydrologic conditions. So we segmented that so that the lagoon is its own segment, and then upstream of the lagoon to the headwaters, a second segment. There's a couple of reasons that happen.
Does Karen Wooster have any thoughts on what might be impacting the two potentially threatened water bodies?
Yeah, the data that supports that categorization is our CCAMP data, and I would hate to speculate, but we have some strong ideas, including some of the stuff we're going to talk about later today. It's ecology. It's all about a combination of things.
Right, and
together,
and she's a biologist, so I'm curious what a biologist thinks about what might be affecting those two water bodies. So if we're going to get to it later, fine.
Well, I'm not sure we're going to get to it later because I'm hesitant to speculate.
Well, I don't want you to speculate. I just want to know if you know what Karen thinks.
Yeah, I do know what Karen thinks.
You should never tell that to
an
attorney.
Are we entitled to know publicly what Karen thinks, or what am I missing here?
I think that we need to collect some more data on some different parameters that we don't have at this point. We need more information to inform a comment on that in public.
That's why Karen didn't come today.
Right. Okay. All right.
Karen's actually just returning from Antarctica, so she's been out.
Yeah. She wanted to get as far away from this board meeting today as she could.
I appreciate your comment, but...
Issue a subpoena for Karen to get here. All right.
But to that note, if you are interested, we can talk to Karen afterwards and see if there is something that any level of confidence that she's comfortable sharing, and if so, we can provide you that information if you're interested.
Okay.
And for your knowledge, she and I have already discussed what additional monitoring we would like to do in the very near future to maybe get at some of the causal things related to the biology condition that we measured here for the benthic inverts. We're also working on some indices to evaluate the habitat data. So things like the substrate, is it all sand? Is it a combination of cobbles and gravels? And using those data that are collected alongside with the benthic community data to actually inform a causal assessment there. There are some things going on, but again, not willing to say with certainty that one causes... Okay, so back to the water quality condition report and how we categorize a water body based on the sum of all of its assessments and decisions. Again, I want to show you how this compares to the previous water quality condition report from the 2008-10. And I got to start here by letting you know that categories 1 through 3, the good and insufficient information categories, the definitions have changed completely. The potentially threatened category is brand new to the 2014 report, and the good quality category and insufficient information definitions change. So I lumped those together here so that we're comparing more of an apples to apples thing. And we did evaluate 51 new water body segments as part of this update. 5 of those were placed into the good or insufficient information category, and then the remaining 44 were placed into the polluted category. Again, this does not mean that we have 44 brand new pollution problems since 2008. It means that we evaluated a lot more data since then and are informing decisions about all these new water bodies. With that, I will transition into talking about some of the public comments we received on this item. We did have a 30-day public comment period. During that time, we held a public workshop, and we acknowledge that 30 days is not a lot of time to understand and go through all this information. And so in addition to holding a public workshop, staff made themselves available to help as much as we could to anyone who reached out and help them walk through the information, get right to the information and water bodies they're interested in. We talked with a lot of people during the public comment period and since to try and be of assistance in that way. We received 9 written letters during the public comment period and provided written responses to 59 comments. And since the release of the agenda for this item, we received 3 additional written items, which are in your packet, one being a letter of support from the Hearst Corporation regarding changes made to Arroyo de la Cruz, which is one of our coastal watersheds in northern SLO County, a request from the City of Santa Cruz for additional time to present additional information to this board today, and you'll hear from them shortly, and then a supplemental letter provided by Kay Mercer for comments she's going to make later this afternoon as well. So back to the letters that we received during the public comment period, some of the key topics were support for some of our recommendations. Commenters identified a few errors, commented and were concerned about data that was not used in this assessment, the age of the data that was used, the amount and volume of information and the formats that it was made available to them in. The comment period was 30 days, and many commenters commented that that's not enough time. We received comments asking us to evaluate data regarding flow and flow alteration, and then some concern for evaluation guidelines that we used to interpret those narrative water quality objectives where we didn't have a basin plan numeric value. And I'll go through each of these briefly. So first, the errors. One commenter identified that E. coli data collected as part of the AB 411 monitoring on our beaches was assessed using the wrong criteria. The fecal coliform criteria was used to assess the E. coli data statewide. The fecal coliform criteria is much higher than the E. coli criteria. So while an exceedance of that criteria assures you that the beach is certainly exceeding the E. coli criteria, the opposite is not true. And if we were to make a delisting recommendation, the data could still be exceeding the criteria and we were making the wrong decision. So in response to those comments, we agreed with them. These data were not assessed using the right criteria, and we left all of those water bodies on the list until those assessments can be redone using the correct criteria. So there are 8 instances where something's staying on the list that may or may not be exceeding criteria. We have to do the analysis to decide.
That's reflected in the 83. The 83 deletions already incorporates that correction.
No, because we decided not to delete those as a result of the comments. So 83 does not include those 8.
Okay.
Because we left them on the list.
Right. Okay.
There would have been 91.
There would have been 91 had we not been made aware of this error in the assessment.
Okay.
So the public review draft that you sent out had 91 recommendations,
yes,
and the version you're seeing now has 83, right? Okay.
Other commenters identified data that was submitted but not assessed and asked us to change our ways regarding that. In one case, we did not have, the State Board had no record of receiving the data during the public comment period. In other instances, there were data quality issues with the data that was submitted, or the data was prioritized low by us based on the fact that it was not in easily usable formats, or we didn't have a criteria or assessment methodology, and it would have taken a lot of staff resources to evaluate those data, and we determined that it was a lower priority to get to those data types. So the outcome is the majority of these data remain unassessed. We didn't make any changes. The exception will be the Carmel and Big Sur information, which we'll talk about in a minute. But in general, data that commenters identified that were not assessed remain unassessed for these reasons.
Hey, can I ask you a question
of
on
course.
That slide? Is it true that a good amount of the comments were expressing concern that data wasn't used that was available because it was more recent than 2010?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So my question is, was it procedurally and time scale wise not possible to reopen a solicitation of public data in March of 2015 when when we renewed our effort in this direction?
That is correct. And in fact, last year, State Board updated the listing policy or amended the listing policy. And one of those amendments, or sorry, the resolution to approve that amendment included a statement about the 2012, 14, and 16 integrated reports will be based on the data that is submitted during 2010 to institutionalize that direction from State Board to the regions.
Okay, so we had no choice but to do it the way that you did it, which makes recent data not usable this time around.
Correct. And this slide gets to that exact question. Many comments about there's newer data, if you're not making informed decisions, there's more information. And based on that State Board direction and then ultimately the resolution when the policy was amended, we didn't make any changes to our assessments because our hands were tied and we were instructed to use the data from the solicitation period.
So,
essentially, they wanted to finish what we received and move forward.
And I was just going to reiterate here that what Mary had said earlier, that we're using this more recent data in all the decision-making we do with respect to permits and TMDLs. It's just with respect to the rules of this listing cycle that we're not.
We received some comments about how massive the fact sheet documentation was, more than 21,000 pages, that the formats were not user-friendly. Some suggestions about that regarding a searchable database or other formats might be more useful. And, of course, some concern about the 30-day public comment period and how short that is to evaluate all that data. And to that, we just want to assure you that we did everything we could to work with people and walk them through the information and help them get to the answers to their questions. And we are also working with State Board to improve this process, both in terms of speed at which these assessments are conducted and the database we're using to improve it, to make it more user-friendly for us, to improve the time under which we can do these assessments, but also the outputs that are available for the public. We've made them aware of some of the concerns and the difficulties, and they're trying to update the database to give better outputs that are more searchable, usable, informative, and not a 21,000 page in a PDF that is organized interestingly. So we're working with them on that process, and it's a resource-intensive process to update the databases and things like that, but things are in the works, and we hope that we have been helpful to the public in trying to get them to the answers to their questions as we went along. This is speaks to the comment you mentioned, Dr. Hunter, and we had a request to evaluate data that was information that was submitted about flow alteration for 5 water bodies in our region. The commenter requested that we assess these data that indicate flow is causing impacts to aquatic life, that we categorize these 5 water bodies differently on the 305 report category than we did, and that as part of the assessment, we identify flow alteration as the cause of these impacts to aquatic life. Now, while we really strongly wanted to go here, it's an important issue for our region. We know it's important to this board. It's important to State Board and water rights. At this time, we did not have the information provided to us, and we don't have an assessment methodology. We don't have criteria to use. There's no objective in the basin plan at this time. And all those factors added up to us deciding not to make the changes as requested at this time. But believe me when I say we're working with State Board staff and internally, because we do want to go down this path. And what we did do in response to these comments was we added a fact sheet for the Carmel River that documents the information that was submitted for Carmel River, talks about the flow alteration, and just institutionalizes it in the record for this process. And then we did go back and review the information for 2 of the rivers that were mentioned here, Carmel and Big Sur. And although we didn't categorize them as requested, based on flow alone being the problem, we did put them in the potentially threatened category because of the biological condition and cited flow alteration as one of the potential causes of that.
I just want to remind the board that the Carmel River is under a cease and desist order for overpumping in the lower and it's a long-standing problem. It is the water supply for Monterey, the Monterey Bay region, and there's a lot of PUC also has a process that's been ongoing for many years, developing an alternative source of water. So, you know, in context, in the larger context of looking at flow conditions, this is one river that has had many different regulatory or agency actions to restore flow in the lower Carmel, and here we are 15, 20 years later, and the situation has not changed. So it's complicated. It's there are many different hurdles that have been technical and otherwise that have been involved with the delays in reducing pumping in that area. So in addition to that, add the drought, et cetera. And so I just felt that this was one particular case that highlights where we have otherwise relatively healthy watershed conditions. Removal of the San Clemente Dam recently to also create a healthier connection between upstream and lower river conditions, et cetera. There's just a lot of work that's been done. And so I think it's a good one to place into this category for exploration and to consider what information we can derive to help establish methods, criteria, and so forth.
But, you know, I think, you know, you certainly bring a good example, but we do have a lot of riparian wells in other water bodies, and particularly during these drought conditions, the amount of water extraction in riparian corridors has increased to compensate for the lack of recharge of the shallow soil profile. So that's number one. But when we talk about flow alteration, I think we need to look at it from two views. One of them, flow alteration due to, you know, human impact, but also flow alteration due to climate change. Again, back to my earlier point, we're on our fifth consecutive year of historical drought. So, you know, flow alteration certainly has been occurring. So, you know, I you know, not to discount what Dr. Hunter said, but I think, again, back to the big picture, that's, I think, it's going to be in your next round, you know, since right now we're in the rearview mirror going back to 2010. I think a lot of this information will significantly change.
And on this topic, I think what we need, and I say this just for your information, is to, under the listing policy, evaluate flow alteration data. We need to clearly link the decline in flows or the alteration impact to aquatic life, a measurable impact, and identify a threshold at which this much flow, no impact, this much flow, impact. And that's the decision-making rules in the listing policy. So our ability to use the 303D list as a tool to identify this is certainly tied to that. And our in California, our 305B water quality condition report decisions are also tied to the rules in the listing policy. So that is the level of information we need to find, in addition to having a water quality objective and then using the anti-degradation part of our authority to get at the problem. But we need that link between this causes this amount of effect for aquatic life.
And in addition to that, there is a state water board directive long-term to perform in-stream flow studies.
Absolutely.
You know, this is a gigantic effort, you know, if we just look at all the water bodies we have. So, you know, you got to chip away at it. But that's also the long term, is that we are required ultimately to have in-stream flow studies being performed.
And to make you aware, our CCAMP program is working with Fish and Game and have been for the last 2 years to do some in our region. Carmel mm-hmm. River is one of those. And although yet we have not collected enough data to set flow objectives there, we're moving in that direction and we're building the data set that we have.
Right, and I'm glad you mentioned fish and wildlife, because that has been one of the prioritization, is to take streams which do have, you know, a higher level of threat, particularly relating to salmon population.
So just to clarify what I think I just heard, we currently don't have minimum stream flow requirements for water bodies. It's something we're working on.
True. We're heading in that direction, yes, absolutely.
Heading in that. And who, what part of our staff is tasked with that?
That would be Karen and I.
Karen and you, okay. All right. Okay, thank you.
But that's something that it's slowly building. This is a partnership that CCAMP has made with Fish and Wildlife. It's not direction from this board to go there. That was...
Right.
Just Karen's forward thinking and getting the ball rolling in advance of.
In using the 303D authority, does that allow for listing and delisting based on water flow?
No. So the 303D list is not for pollution. It's
right.
For pollutants.
That's why I'm asking.
And the flow would be categorized into the category on the water quality condition report that's related to pollution, so things like flow. But in California, to make decisions about how to categorize water bodies, we also follow the sample count and exceedance count and rules about deciding what criteria to use to make a decision that are in the listing policy to inform our decisions about the categories. So although it can't be put on the 303D list, the way we make decisions in California is to follow the rules that we would use to evaluate stuff for that purpose as well.
And we can use flow.
I think we can, and I think we should.
Part of that assessment. Okay.
Thank you. That's a good discussion. A few more. We had some concerns about use of evaluation guidelines, specifically about the water quality guidelines to use nitrate and be protective of aquatic life. The evaluation guideline we use does meet the requirements of the listing policy for choosing an evaluation guideline to interpret a narrative water quality objective, and we have used this specific evaluation guideline in previous assessment cycles. We did not make any changes as a result of these comments. And a similar comment about using evaluation guidelines for temperature in San Lorenzo River specifically, and again, that temperature evaluation guideline met the requirements of the listing policy. And in this case, we actually worked with partners at NOAA and NIMFS specifically to confirm that the number we were using is relevant for the species that are in this watershed. And with that, I'll conclude our information on the public comments and just remind you that this update builds on the 2008-10 integrated report, which was based on data from 2006 and older. These updates are based on data that was submitted in the 2010 public data solicitation, and want to remind you that that public data solicitation is a required part of the policy. It's always going to have that deadline as part of this process, and that we do use all available new data in making decisions, but just not for this integrated report update. That this integrated report does inform priority and timing, specifically for our grants and TMDL programs, but also for our permit programs. And the permit programs and TMDLs do use the new data when they're developing their projects. The TMDL priorities that we've set here, the order in which we plan to address these pollutant problems, are aligned with the priorities of this board to protect aquatic life and human health uses. And I wanted to reassure you that we are working with the state board to improve this process for the future. And with that, provide you with our recommendation, which is to adopt the resolution approving the changes to the 303D list for the Central Coast.
Thank you. And we do have speaker cards for this topic, and I'm looking at the time, and I think this would be an appropriate time to take a 15-minute break before we move to the next segment. So it's 10:45. Let's reconvene at 11. Thank you.